Welcome to the CodeCast Podcast. Real-world insights for your daily medical coding and billing processes. And now, here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CodeCast Podcast today. My name is Terry Fletcher. We are in episode 441. It is the last Tuesday of April, which means we are at a top 10 Tuesday segment today. So I'm actually excited about this. I've had a lot of questions from my Coding Corner clients, and welcome to the new clients. We've had several new clients that have joined our executive membership. And if you're wondering what the Coding Corner is, it's a question and answer membership platform that you can join. We have two different tiers. We have regular membership at $1,200 a year, $1,800 a year for the executive membership, and it includes an Ask Me Anything Zoom call every quarter. So we get on and we can share ideas. I can let you know what's happening in the industry. And it also includes some free webinars, some discounts on auditing services, etc. So take a look at it. It's at terryfletcher.net. Go to services, and it's the first pull down item on our services page. So Top 10 Tuesday today is basically a compilation that I do over the last month or two, depending on how many questions I get on coding, billing, compliance. And it's just important for you to know some of this information. Sometimes I'll take one and run with it and put it on an article or a blog on my website, which you can see. But for this one, I really wanted to have a complete Q&A for information that's all over the place. So this is definitely multi-specialty. So let's take a look. So for number one, for e-visit codes 99421 to 99423, you might have also heard them called digital codes. They are part of what we call the acronym CBTS, Communication-Based Technology Services, and not really under the telehealth title, because they've been paid regardless of the public health emergency. They're not under the flexibilities. These are paid as long as you meet the criteria. But a question has come in: what is the correct place of service code? Well, remember, these are for patients that are established, and it's what is expected is that your physician is sitting in their office and they're getting emailed questions, or portal questions, I should say, from the existing patient. I know I use my portal, unfortunately, often, mostly to my nutritionist, but and they go back and forth if they have a question or a clarification on medicine, or they want to know if they, you know, eat this certain food, if there'll be an interaction, or they skipped something and they just need some information from their provider. And these are answered by the physician or the mid-level provider, not the nursing staff. And your place of service is office, so that would be 11. And so take a look at those. Many payers pay for them. Medicare pays for them. Medicare Advantage pays for them, but that's an important distinction. Number two, what is the code for a Medicare patient here for a screening colonoscopy, but they're not high risk? So let's say they had a screening 10 years ago, no findings, they have no family or personal history of polyps. They're really only age appropriate for screening once again. So your code is, and it's not a CPT code, it's a HCPCS code, which means it's a Medicare recognized code, G0121. And so that's where it basically is not a high-risk patient. Number three, and this one I actually got several of them, and I do try to condense my questions too if I get duplication. This is on surgical procedures. It says, can the providers have shared documentation and refer to themselves in the third person in order to bill as co-surgeons? That would be no. So it's pretty clear on the CMS website. It's in the Medicare manual, integrity manual. And it says, and I'm going to quote, each surgeon should document their distinct operative work in a separate operative report. It says claims from both co-surgeons should report the same procedure code with modifier 62 appended. And if you want to see the most recent transmittal on that, it's R1781CP. Question four, it says, Terry, I'm being told the patient purchased an FDA-approved device like a CardioPro, but they are not enrolled in any program. They just bring their EKG rhythm strips to the doctor. He reviews and interprets them, sometimes 20 in 1 month. Is that billable? Okay, so the question is interesting, because even though it's FDA approved on the site, it's not billable because devices must transmit the data automatically to the provider, the physician, and the provider physician, again, must have staff or pay outside staff for 20 that are clinical under their supervision for 20 minutes a month minimum, and there must be an interactive communication with the patient on this. So you have to make sure that it goes directly to the doctor, and you know, so those of you that watch Law and Order, this is kind of a chain of custody situation. So you have to make sure that it's going directly to the physician. It can't just be a patient bringing in these strips and them interpreting them. And remember, this is also a time-based code. And so again, bringing just in random strips and hoping it's FDA approved, even if it's on a list, is not something that you can be lazy about. So that's the best way for me to kind of put that out there. Now, I'm still getting a lot of questions. I've even got more today that I did not include in our top 10, but I will be including it probably next week. I think it's time to do another telemedicine not just webinar, but also some more podcast information. But number five says, Terry, we stay confused with these telemedicine visits. The provider documented the entirety of his encounter was done via telemedicine. Would he need to attend the state? To state the type of telemedicine, whether it be audio, video, or audio only? Yes, you have to make sure that there's something, and I wouldn't do it as an addendum. You need to make sure it's done the first time, not only if it's audio and video or audio only, because one is time-based and one is potentially you're able to use an office visit. And that's the reason, is because there are two different types of codes, two different types of reimbursement, but there's also rules around both of them. Audio only is for established only, and you also have to put down why they were not available for audio and video. And you have to make sure you're also saying what kind of platform, because remember, as of August 1st of last year, now the Office of Civil Rights said you better make sure that it's FDA approved platforms like your EMR, like any service you pay for, that you're using. It can't just be Zoom. It can't be FaceTime. It can't be any kind of just app that you have on your smartphone. It has to be an actually approved type of device, and it has to have HIPAA, you know, rules or securities on it, which means you would have to be entering into a BAA to make sure that the patient isn't compromised. And just look at all of the compromising that's going on right now. Change Healthcare and hospitals are getting in trouble because third parties are basically spying on patients because you don't have that in place. So yes, you have to state what type of telemedicine, telehealth you're doing, audio, video, or audio only, and what platform you're using. The CodeCast podcast is also brought to you today by Just Coding, your online continuing education destination. Pay one price and earn dozens of AAPC, ACDIS, and AHIMA credits annually. Save 10% off a new subscription using the coupon code SAVE10. Visit justcoding.com to subscribe. And that is a product through Decision Health. Number six, there is some confusion on PA, nurse practitioner, and advanced practice providers when they can have new patient visits. So I had a coding manager send to me, says, I have a doctor pushing back on this. I just want to be sure I'm correct and have your input in my pocket when we go to the arena. And believe me, sometimes it is like a gladiator kind of fight there when you're going back against your providers. So it says, both patients have been seen within the last 3 years at an urgent care center by a mid-level provider. They said, because a mid-level cannot hold a specialty when they're, when they're seen with the doctor who is pediatrics, that should be new, correct? And they said, however, since they saw first the pediatric physician and then they were seen in the urgent care by a mid-level, all the no specialty, those are established. But again, if they saw the doctor who is just a family medical provider, could they be new? Okay, I know that sounds all confusing. So here's the rule, and this is tough for some large hospital systems, some large medical systems that they kind of are all under one umbrella. If you have mid-level providers working with your specialists, whether they be pediatrics or surgical specialists or medical specialists, it doesn't matter. As soon as they start working with that type of physician, whatever specialty that physician is, they become that physician's specialty. So if they're seen by the pediatric physician and then They're seen in an urgent care for pediatric issues, but they're all under the same umbrella. So that means that there's a financial tie, there's a tax ID, everybody's part of the same practice. That's the same specialty. So if they were going to, let's say they were seeing a pediatric physician, and then they went to an urgent care center that had nothing to do with the company or the practice of the pediatric doctor. So it was a completely different entity, and they were seeing a mid-level. Of course, that would be new to that mid-level because it's a totally different entity. But when your mid-levels work with you, they now have taken on your specialty. So try not to be fooled by that, because you could be overcoding, or especially new patient visits, when it's not appropriate. The other thing to keep in mind with urgent care, and this has kind of been, gosh, this eats at me every day, is a lot of urgent care centers, they're trying to be urgent cares when actually they're more like walk-in primary care health clinics, because they tell the patient that you can follow up with us. Urgent care is supposed to be just that. It's supposed to be urgent care instead of wanting to go wait in the ER at the hospital. So you could lose your designation if you're not careful. So be careful with that. Number 7, Terry, our physician performed an atherectomy and a thrombectomy, but I am seeing an edit that this cannot be billed together. That's correct. Okay, so remember, if you're trying to figure out coding, and especially if it's a new specialty for you, atherectomy, what does that mean? Well, read the code. Atherosclerosis, ectomy means to take out, so you're taking out the atherosclerosis, you're taking out the disease. Thrombectomy, what's a thrombus? It's blood clot. So you're taking out a thrombus, ectomy, okay? So while you're in there, an atherectomy is basically a type of bladed catheter-based tool that takes out that atherosclerosis in the lower extremities, 33229. Well, if you're trying to bill a thrombectomy at the same time, which would be secondary, 37186, the CCI manual, chapter 5, section D27, chapter verse there, it says thrombectomy of a thrombus in the vascular territory of a diseased artery is inherent, that means included, in the work for atherectomy procedure. CPT code 37186 for secondary percutaneous transpneumonal thrombectomy shall not be reported for the removal of such thrombus. For example, if a physician performs in lower extremity endovascular revascularization atherectomy, removal of any thrombus from the vascular territory of the vessel treated with an atherectomy is not separately reportable. So it doesn't apply to stenting or angioplasty in the lower extremities, but it does apply to atherectomy. So it's important that you know that not all edits apply to all codes in the same interventional category. And I just actually taught a peripheral vascular webinar. You can still get it online if you need to. And this was something that came up in there. So just understand the difference. Terry, number 8, I have an interventional cardiologist and an EP physician, electrophysiologist, from the same practice, same tax ID. They rounded on the same patient on the same day in the hospital. Uh-oh. Can ENM claims be billed for both? The interventionalist saw the patient first and then felt that the patient needed to be consulted by the EP physician for an arrhythmia and a potential device implantation like a pacemaker. So do I have to look at the CPT new versus established rule? Well, in the hospital, it's different, okay? It's per stay. So yes, they can both see the same patient. The problem is that it's per stay, where you can only bill the initial hospital. So the first physician that saw the patient in consult, or even if they admitted them, would be the 99221 to 99223 codes. But then if they call in an EP physician, again, it doesn't matter if it's new versus established in the hospital, it's per stay. That second physician would have to use the follow-up visits, even if it was their initial encounter, which are the 99231 to 992333 codes, because it's the same day, but they're considered the same group practice and subspecial, same specialty, subspecialty, and EP is considered a subspecialty for this situation. So it doesn't matter about tax ID, it matters about the rules during the same hospital stay and under the same group practice. Number 9, under medical decision-making data, I just love these questions. So x-rays, says we have a radiology department and our radiology techs do the x-rays and the radiologist reads and writes the interpretation. If our provider orders this at the visit, can it be counted in the data element as test ordered since it's performed and billed under a different provider's specialty in the practice? Says my understanding is that if the provider orders, performs, and bills under the same provider, we cannot count it. Is this correct? Yes, that's correct. So if you've got a rad department in the hospital and their radiologist, because they usually don't have private practice, and they're reading the and writing interpretation, and but your physician is the one that ordered it. You get credit under the data points under category one for the order, okay? Number 10, and this is the final one. Let's say all the requirements are met in order to report the GO136. Okay, what is that? That's the social determinants of health assessment that's now available every 6 months. This is best practice would be to report and link the social determinant of health Z code to the GO136. What if the patient does not want that particular Z code on their claim? What would we link instead? We will be performing SDOH with all of our annual well visits. On what cases would we not report the GO136? Would it be appropriate to report Z13.9 to identify that special screenings were done? Okay, so this is a complicated question. And it's a dilemma because for those of us who have been doing this a long time, I'm in my 40th year of healthcare, my 30th year as a consultant. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because we had to deal with this with HIV patients back in the day. And then they came out with, and I'm going to say it, that stupid code of not being vaccinated that came out in 2021, and people were not happy. It was added to the claim, and now they felt that they were a target. So if you can't use the Z code, then what unmet need are you addressing? Remember, the social determinant of health code GO136 is not a screening. It is considered an assessment for a patient who has unmet needs. And so it's like smoking cessation, where the patient doesn't want that they are a smoker on their claim because that could hurt them getting life insurance in the future. But if the provider wants to charge for the smoking cessation code from, you know, a 3 to 10 minute discussion and the patient's agreeing to quit and all of that, then you can't code it because you don't have a linking diagnosis. Well, the same thing here. I have heard that patients don't want anything that has to do with their inability to get some because they're homeless. They don't want that as part of their medical record, or that they have a financial strain, unable to afford their medications, or that they unfortunately lack the education to be able to understand what, you know, their current medical condition is. And so that's hindering their access to care. But there's a reason these assessments are important. It's because not just for statistical information for the American Medical Association and understanding, you know, world health, but it's important for the physician to, when they take their time to understand the total health picture of the patient, where some of these challenges stem from. And they should get paid for that. And that is worth about $18. But again, it's not a screening. It's once every 6 months. You might actually run up against another physician or another provider billing for it as well. And if it's the same, you know, social determinant of health diagnosis, you may not get yours reimbursed. They haven't said that yet, but I could see that. So if you have patients that, you know, really refuse that, I would be concerned about that. And remember, the last part of this said you're billing it with all your annual well visits. Well, the brand new information on annual well visits from February 2024 said that it's voluntary, but they do expect that you're asking them, or your part of your risk factor reduction is about the social determinants of health. So I think it would be inappropriate to bill this with every single annual well visit if the patient doesn't have an unmet need. Just because you're having the discussion doesn't mean that you're going to be coding for it. It just means that now you're going to, let's say that they are not unable to get nutritious food, they're diabetic, they have to have Meals on Wheels, all that, and you're going to set them up with community programs to be able to do that based off of that assessment. It's billable. But let's say that's not an issue for the patient. All you did was ask some questions, there was no problems. You can't bill it because, again, it's an assessment, not a screening. So hopefully you found that helpful, because I think there needed to be some clarifications there. I think sometimes when we get some of these new codes, and I know that I'm going to be presenting, I think for Alaska AAPC on May 4th, and then on, I'm actually doing something on a Saturday, don't tell anyone. And then on May 21st for Johnstown, PA, it's noon Eastern time, but 9 a.m. My time, we're doing something on all the new G codes for 2024 and how to report them, be compliant, everything. But sometimes when we get these new codes, I think people kind of just say, oh my gosh, let's just put it on everything. And, you know, like peanut butter and jelly, I always am going to add my jelly. Not all the time. Not all the time. You got to be careful. It's not always appropriate. And so we have to make sure first it's medically necessary. First, the encounter is appropriate for the code. and that the documentation can support the code and not in a generic way. All right, and just a little side note, I guess my personal tidbit for today. So I mentioned at the beginning that I do every once in a while talk to a nutritionist on my portal through my provider's office. Last year, I was diagnosed, unfortunately, with diabetes, but my A1C now is normal limits. I'm on the metformin. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. I've lost 70 pounds. I'm so excited. I'm just really doing things that are right. But okay, we're human. How many of you get cravings for a Big Mac? I know I do, but you can't have those anymore. But I found an out. I found a trick, a hack, whatever you want to call it. And it came from actually nutritionists. One thing I did not know about Big Macs and McDonald's food, let's face it, it's terrible for you. But just on an occasion, like maybe not every, but once a quarter, if you feel like it, the biggest problem is the bread and the salt. And so you can actually get on the app and you can get a Big Mac and say, and put no bun, extra lettuce, extra pickles, no salt. And you've taken off about 1,000 calories. So instead of your 1,300 calories or whatever for that, you're now down to about 350. And you can have a little bit of the mac sauce, you get the lettuce, the pickles, that you can get the cheese, and you get, you know, the two beef patties. And it's just amazing to me. Now I have my craving sufficed. I don't feel like I've cheated. I've saved myself about 40 grams of fat, about 1,000 calories, and nobody's the wiser. So anyway, just something to think about if you are like me and once in a while you just have to have it or you're going to go crazy. And so little things around that. Now, if any of you have any hacks on how I can have a chocolate chip cookie without losing my mind, let me know, because you know I'm a cookie monster, but I have not had a chocolate chip cookie in almost a year now. There is an occasion where my husband will get one from Starbucks and he'll let me have a bite. He's just so kind, isn't he? He says, honey, for you, anything. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Anyway, everyone, thanks for listening today. Make it a great day. Make it a great rest of your week. And thank you for listening to the CodeCast podcast.
For more information on medical coding, billing, auditing, and compliance, including how to hire Terry, follow Terry on Twitter at TerryCoder1 or visit her website at www.terryfletcher.net. Podcast producer Joe Kuzma. Music producer DeSassin Music.